Everybody, this is Left, Right, and Center. I am David Green. Total chaos at the Pentagon. That is a headline that should probably worry any American. Particularly troubling, though, when the words come from someone who worked inside the Pentagon just until recently and remains philosophically a pretty big supporter of President Trump and also Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. So this criticism is not coming from some deep state bureaucrat or Trump hater. It is coming from John Elliott, who has been Hegseth's spokesman. He also worked in the first Trump administration, also worked on the Trump campaign in 2016, but he left his post and has now written an op-ed in Politico describing a month from hell at the Department of Defense. His op-ed was published the same day that the New York Times reported on a second chat group in the messaging app Signal, where Hegseth shared sensitive details of a planned strike on Yemen, this time with his wife and other personal contacts. Now, we should say Secretary Hegseth is downplaying all of this.
What was shared over Signal then and now, however you characterize it, was informal, unclassified coordinations for media coordination and other things. That's what I've said from the beginning.
Okay, so President Trump is defending Hegseth publicly, but NPR reported this week that a search was underway for a possible replacement. And Hegseth, we should say, is not the only cabinet member under scrutiny for perceived mismanagement. So is our government being run by incompetent people, or is this the trade-off when a president comes in promising radical but necessary change in Washington? You know, you get less traditional people chosen for top roles. They're just going to slip up in the beginning because they're less experienced. Mo and Sarah are both away this week, but we have some great folks joining us. On the left, Lily Adams, a veteran communication strategist. She was Assistant Secretary of Public Affairs at the Treasury Department under President Biden, also worked over the years for Kamala Harris and for Hillary Clinton. And on the right, Mike Dubke is back. He's a veteran GOP communication strategist and advisor. He was the White House Director of Communications under Donald Trump in 2017. Lily, Mike, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having us, David.
Yeah,
great,
we really appreciate it. Yeah, thank you. A lot to talk about. That is a scary headline, I think, the hearing that there's total chaos and a top official at the Pentagon experienced a month of hell inside a department that's pretty important to our national security. Mike, how worried should Americans be reading stuff like this?
I don't think Americans should be worried at this point, reading headlines such as a month from hell or the other items that are coming out from the White House. What they should be concerned about, though, is that this is coming from some of the insiders that have been personally chosen by the secretary and are now on their way out the door. So I think there's a couple of different things that are happening here, David. One is Signalgate, whatever we want to call it. And that is, that probably can be defined in what you were talking about at the beginning of this, segment. We've got individuals that are been brought into government to shake things up, and they're doing things at a they're doing things differently, but they're also doing things at a rate of speed that is unusual for Washington, D.C. And we can get into that and the, you know, the positives and the negatives of that. But I think that's, we're seeing some growing pains, as you put it. What concerns me the most, however, in this particular instance, are the individuals who are speaking out that were brought in. These are not generals that have been fired because they participated in the awful withdrawal from Afghanistan. These are not other Pentagon officials who have been there and decided that we were going to be more of a woke army than we were going to be a lethal force. These are the individuals handpicked, and they're coming out and they're talking about a month of hell. That's unusual. The American people should be worried about that. But that's a little different than some of all the other things that have been going on in D.C. over the last 94 days. 95 days.
Yeah, Lily, do you see something sort of different about this, a shift, because it is coming from people who were both chosen by Donald Trump, by Pete Hegseth, and were loyalists? This is a former official, again, not with an obvious axe to grind, coming out and saying, like, this is bad.
Yeah, that's exactly right, David. I mean, I think Mike and I have both served in administrations where you're a senior spokesperson. When the press folks are leaving and they're going scorched earth, then you've got a real problem. They're the people who usually are trying to put spin on the ball to, you know, try to paper over things or put a good face on a problem. But I guess we shouldn't be that surprised. I mean, Pete Hegseth had no qualifications for this role. He was a weekend TV host. He had a poor record of running organizations that were a fraction the size of the Pentagon. I mean, this is a guy who's just more focused on waging war against liberals than he is like waging war against our adversaries. So I just, this is somebody who's wholly unqualified to run an extremely complicated, high stakes part of the government.
You know, I'm interested in the op-ed that Elliot wrote. I mean, he said one reason the American people gave Trump a conclusive victory last November is that he's not a go-along, get-along creature of the Beltway like many of his recent predecessors, but rather a shrewd businessman who expects results and holds his team accountable for serious mistakes that occur on their watch. It's really interesting to think about the different aspects of Trump that appeal to people here that seem like they might be competing with one another. It's the Trump who's going to come to Washington and change a lot and bring in untraditional people into leadership roles, but also like a Trump who's going to be the you're fired guy who's not going to accept incompetence. And I mean, Mike, is this a moment where he sort of has to make a choice between those two characteristics of his own?
Well, I think, again, you know, part of what Trump brought to Washington, especially this time, more so in Trump 2.0 than in Trump 1.0, is in order to effectuate change, you needed individuals who could articulate that change. I think in Trump 1.0, we had a number of very fine individuals that served as cabinet secretaries, but they didn't have necessarily the toolkit to communicate that change to the American people. And so you've got this weird decision that you have to make. Do you want somebody who's a better marketer than they are a manager, or a better manager than they are a marketer? And I'd argue, you know, we've almost always leaned towards having managers in the cabinet secretary roles and less so marketers. And with Hegseth, with RFK Jr., with Kristi Noem, I think we've got a number of individuals that really understand how to communicate to the American people the changes that they are wringing out of the agencies that they are running. The problem that Hegseth has, not to belabor this point, is that you then need to bring in managers beneath you to really run that agency, to run the Pentagon. And it seems like we've had a failure to be able to do that. Marco Rubio might stand out in this administration thus far as somebody who can articulate a vision as well as manage the State Department. But, you know, as I said earlier, when we get down to it, what Donald Trump is trying to do here is to have change and have change happen quickly. I think he realizes that if he's got unified government, it may only be until 2026. And so whatever changes that he makes, he has to do in that 2-year period. And then the other part about this, David, and I'll leave it at this, the really hard thing for Trump at the moment is that if he gets rid of Hegseth, what does that mean to the United States Senate and passing one big, beautiful bill, getting all the other legislation passed? I mean, we're going to have another nomination fight for a position that really can't stay empty for too long.
Yeah.
So that's something else that I'm sure is weighing on the president's mind.
Lily, do you accept Mike's point that someone in the role of Marco Rubio, in the mold of Marco Rubio, is doing a job that you can accept more than someone like Pete Hegseth? You know, obviously Rubio has done some things that have infuriated people on the left, and including, you know, cutting foreign aid and cutting foreign aid jobs. But if he, you know, has an agency that seems to be running well, as Mike is arguing, and he's an effective messenger, is that more acceptable than someone who, you know, is appearing pretty incompetent right now and at the Pentagon?
Yeah, I can absolutely have policy disagreements with the way that Secretary Rubio is running the State Department, but I totally agree with your word incompetence. Like what we're seeing with Pete Hegseth, if I were working in the White House, is just that every single day he is distracting from whatever is their hoped for message of the day. And that would be, at best, annoying. And at worst, it's going to make it more challenging to get their agenda passed. Like, we had an entire election fought over the security of classified information. It's what helped elect Donald Trump in the first place. And you're telling me this guy has signal chats with, it seems like, everybody, including reporters, his brother, his sister, his wife, people who don't have.
I'm waiting to be included. I'm waiting.
Exactly. I'm a little offended, frankly, David, that I'm not on the chats, you know? If I were sitting in the White House, I would.
I'll see if I can add you.
Not tolerate this for that long. Yeah. We just have to get Mike to get us in there.
Yeah. Well, I Kristi Noem at Homeland Security is an interesting one because, I mean, Mike, you said that she is an effective messenger, at least better than Pete Hegseth. But, I mean, there's been Wall Street Journal reporting that some of her kind of focus on photo ops has actually interfered with ICE operations, that she tipped people off by posting a photo from an impending New York City ICE raid. Like, that's feels like an interesting one to follow, like where you could actually see the marketing and the messaging getting in the way of substantive work. Is that really sort of the crucial thing that we should be following as we pick apart which cabinet secretaries are effective and which are really problematic?
Well, obviously, we can pick apart anybody's action, especially if you disagree with it. You will look for those instances where maybe a picture got posted too early, a situation was created to be more of a photo op than it was to be a police raid. But there is a method to the madness of having her out there and really sending a message outside of internally for American consumption. That this is a you know, serious action. We're finally getting serious about the southern border. That's number one. But if, as we've seen, the number of interactions at the southern border have dropped to almost zero, to a trickle. And part of that is because of the messaging that's being sent south of the border that, you know, if you come here, you're not going to be able to get in the country anymore. You're not going to just be able to be, say hi to the border guard and then continue on your way into the United States. And so there is a method to this. And we saw it in the first Trump administration where crossing numbers went down. Biden kind of did not enforce the border for whatever reason. He chose not to do it. And that's a whole other debate. And when you see that enforcement and it's trickling through social media, it's trickling through legacy media, that's important. And that's, you know, I think that's a big accomplishment. And that's part of the marketing.
Lily, is that fair? There's been some effective messaging for this administration that's actually slowed down border crossings and made it safer?
No, I think you've had an administration that's chock full of cabinet secretaries who have an audience of one. That's the president. They're producing a television show. They're not running a government competently. So I don't deny that they've had a consistent message about the southern border, and we can debate the merits of that and whether it's gotten through. But I don't think that anyone who honestly looks at how these agencies are being managed would argue that, you know, Kristi Noem or Pete Hegseth or any of these folks are really trying to run an agency that is in service of the American people. They want to run it in service of the president, and they want the president to continue to bless them so that they can continue to stay in their posts. They're not, though, serving on behalf of how people have normally done these roles, which is that their constituency, you know, is we hope, the American people first, not the president.
I would just briefly on this, I think this is one of those areas where I do believe Donald Trump was elected by the American people to shake things up. I mean, we can argue about the economy, we can argue about the border, but ultimately the one thing you knew you were going to get with Donald Trump is that he was going to be unconventional, that he was going to shake things up. And, you know, until we got into this tariff, and we can get into his poll numbers later, but those first kind of halcyon days of chaos, it did not affect his poll numbers. And I think part of that is because the American people were sick of the same old, same old. So I think I agree with you that they are trying to impress the president. I just, and this is my partisan stripes showing right here, thank God we have a president that seems to be at least in control that his cabinet secretaries are dealing with, rather than someone where we weren't exactly sure in the last 18 months of the regime who was running the government.
But Mike, I would just say, like, the chaos, you said that the chaos, you're talking about it as a good thing. The chaos is everywhere. The Dow just had its worst April since the 1930s. Retailers are warning the president that they're going to be empty shelves. Retirees are concerned about whether they're going to be able to retire. I don't think the American people are going to be a fan of this chaos for that long. And that shows he has the worst polling numbers of a president, any president at this point in their presidency, in history.
No, and that's why I put a timestamp on my halcyon days, because I agree with you now. We're in a different territory than we were in the first month.
All right, we're going to take a break. Lily and Mike and I are going to come back, and we're going to start with the passing of Pope Francis. That's ahead on Left, Right, and Center. All right, we are back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green. Sarah and Mo are both off today. We have Lily Adams on the left. She's former Assistant Secretary of Public Affairs at the Treasury Department under Joe Biden. And on the right, Mike Dupke, former White House Director of Communications during Donald Trump's first term. And I want to turn now to the passing of Pope Francis and the Pope's legacy. He died this past Monday. I feel like he was a different Pope than I ever remember in my lifetime. Relatively progressive and outspoken on issues like the rights of migrants, gay Catholics, and that sometimes put him at odds with American Catholic leaders who I think, as we've been seeing, have been sounding more conservative in recent years. In his final public appearance, the Pope on Easter Sunday advocated for a ceasefire in Gaza. And I guess I just want to start, Lily, as I understand you're a practicing Catholic, and I guess I just wonder what you think about when it comes to his political legacy, particularly here in the U.S.
Well, I mean, I can't speak for all Catholics.
No, I'm not asking you to.
I think what made him stand out was that he promoted mercy and humility and empathy far more than punishing sin. I think sometimes the American Catholic Church has focused so much on winning or fighting the culture wars that they've forgotten that mercy and that empathy and that humility. More than any pope, certainly in my lifetime, he was a pastor. He was sort of more of the, a pastor for the 1.4 billion Catholics around the world than he was sort of a monarch leading this very rigid institution. I think there'll be a lot of debate about, how successful he was at changing the church and his legacy and whatnot. But I think just from a values perspective, it was that compassion that I think spoke to, certainly a lot of people who have, my brand of Catholicism.
Mike, it was sort of just stunning that one of his last meetings was with Vice President J.D. Vance, to me, because it just made it so stark, sort of some of the debates and conversations between the Vatican led by this Pope and American Catholic leaders and the Trump administration. I want to dive into a lot of that in a few minutes, but I just wonder, how do you see this Pope's impact on the larger political conversation in the United States?
Well, as a practicing Presbyterian, I'll have to...
who's not going to speak for all Presbyterians. We should
give you the same caveat. Who is not going to speak for all Presbyterian, yeah. Or Presbyterian USA or all the different presbyteries out there. I think what Lily said really does sum up quite a bit of what his import was to the world. I think there was a very different... I had the privilege of meeting John Paul II, and I think his role in history was really a very different role in a very different Catholic Church at a very different time than what we had with Pope Francis. We had Pope Benedict for that kind of interim period that I think everyone forgets. No one really talks about Benedict anymore. But from a historical standpoint, actually stepping down from the papacy was quite an act. And I'm not even really sure why he did it, but it could have been for the betterment of the church. And if it was, they went in a very different direction when they chose Pope Francis. So what I'm interested in, because I think he was more about, in Lily's words, empathy and looking out for those who are less fortunate than he was in the geopolitical realm that John Paul played in, and I think Benedict tried to play in. So from that standpoint, I think that losing that voice is going to be hard, not just in the United States, but around the world. What I'm fascinated by, and not just because I saw the movie Conclave a couple weeks ago.
I did too, the day before Francis died. And now I'm like, how much of it is true? Is what's happening now behind behind the scenes exactly like Ralph Fiennes or totally different? Anyway.
So, yeah. David, it's you watching movies and for everyone else shaking the hand of J.D. Vance, it sounds like,
yeah.
on the last
day. Yeah, those two things are about those mean things. Your end. Yeah.
No, but in all seriousness, like, where does the church go from here? Do they want to be more political? Are they going to turn to the conflicts that we have in Gaza, Ukraine? Are we looking for a pope that is going to turn the church to be more traditional? Because the fastest growing areas of the world for the Catholic Church are in Africa and Asia. And those are not necessarily liberal cardinals coming from those areas. So is this church going to turn more conservative the way that a number of governments have gone? I think there's, you know, so I'm fascinated by this interplay between religion, governments. Francis was a man for his time, and he was elected during a period of time in which we did have a much more liberal outlook. And now I believe the world's got a more conservative outlook. Is that going to transfer over to the Catholic Church? So I'm fascinated by all of these things, but I think in terms of your question, Francis's legacy is going to be one of compassion.
Hmm. I guess what I'm hearing from Mike, and tell me if you agree, Lily, is the political movement in our world right now going to be linked to a similar movement to a more conservative place for the Catholic Church? And is that kind of what's riding on, you know, that question is what's riding on this decision that we're about to see?
It's a really good question. Although, you know, I think that Francis's legacy might be sort of felt in this conclave. He appointed 80% of the 135 cardinals who are going to be in the Sistine Chapel. So he was a vote counter, I think, as well as an empathetic pastor. But I think
the whip. I hadn't
exactly.
Thought about
I mean,
that
there's a little Nancy Pelosi-ness, you know, to him that's going to be felt maybe. But I do think it is interesting. But I think just to be realistic is that the papacy is very different than it was 10 years ago, 50 years ago, 100 years ago. And I think the amount of power it has in sort of geopolitics like it used to just has diminished quite a bit. And so I do think there is a question sort of, you know, that is fascinating everybody who they're going to go with. Do you go with sort of, again, to Mike's point, more conservative leaders from growing parts of the Catholic Church, or do you go actually with one of the probably the Italian candidates who are shockingly a little bit more liberal and progressive, which has not always historically been the case. But I do think there's a sort of reality check question of just how much power does the Pope really have anymore? I think what Francis understood, I think, is that he was a messenger. He could set the tone. He could sort of weigh in on things. But, you know, again, he had real trouble making institutional change.
I just a short comment on this. I want to push back only slightly because I think on Saturday, when we see the world leaders that gather, I can't think of many individuals in the world leaders, that would attract probably such a diverse group of individuals. President Trump's going to be going to the funeral. I expect most of the heads of state in Europe and around the world will be there. And there is just something about this particular position, Pope. We don't have it in other denominations in the same way that we do with the Roman Catholics. And there's just something that is timeless with that. So I do think who is next is going to be important. And I'm saying that as a Presbyterian again.
Yeah, important, sure. It's just at some point it's limited.
Yeah.
Fair.
All right, you're listening to Left, Right, and Center from KCRW. We're talking about the passing of Pope Francis and kind of this moment for the Catholic Church and also the relationship and the conversation, the debate that I think this Pope had with Catholic leaders in the United States. And I wanted to dive into one aspect of that. And Vice President J.D. Vance is at the center of it. There's this Latin phrase in Catholic teaching, Ordo Amoris. It essentially means order of love. And it's been interpreted as outlining sort of a hierarchy of care. You love God first, and then that's followed by yourself, and then your family, and your neighbors. And I do not want to get in trouble by saying any more and trying to interpret what Latin Catholic teaching means, but that's essentially the accepted message. But it's been used for different ends by different people over time. And Vice President Vance has used the philosophy to defend the Trump administration's tough immigration policies.
And as an American leader, but also just as an American citizen, your compassion belongs first to your fellow citizens. It doesn't mean you hate people from outside of your own borders, but there's this old school, and I think it's a very Christian concept, by the way, that you love your family, and then you love your neighbor, and then you love your community, and then you love your fellow citizens in your own country. And then after that, you can focus and prioritize the rest of the world. A lot of the far left has completely inverted that. They seem to hate the citizens of their own country and care more about people outside their own borders. That is no way to run a society.
All right, so that was Vance on Fox News in January. He later tweeted, making clear that he was talking about Ordo Amoris. And he was then put in his place, in a way, by none other than Pope Francis. The Pope wrote this letter in February to U.S. bishops offering views on what he described as mass deportations in the United States. And he seemed to jab at J.D. Vance's interpretation of Ordo Amoris. The Pope wrote that Christian love is not a concentric expansion of interests that little by little extend to other persons and groups. He said the true Ordo Amoris involves meditating on the love that builds a fraternity open to all without exception. This really hit me in a fascinating way and had me thinking. And I think one thing that came to me is, like, do these things have to be mutually exclusive? Like, Vance seems to be arguing that it has to be a choice. If you care about migrants, as the Pope does, that's going to put your own family in danger. You can't love migrants and keep your family safe, which I think is really dangerous. And, you know, we could debate the facts about crime in the United States and how putting the blame on immigrants is, you know, in my view, pretty dishonest and inaccurate. But I'm more interested in the philosophical conversation here. I mean, Mike, do you see legitimacy in what Vance is arguing, using this concept to basically say that the left has inverted something in this way, and, you know, to keep our country safe and have solid immigration policy, this is how you have to interpret this?
So I don't believe that we need to look at immigration policy through the lens of religion. To me, national security is the reason why we need strong borders. Now, that is to protect your family and to protect your fellow citizens, but it's also to create a level of safety that doesn't in any way impugn the reasons that migrants, illegal immigrants into the country, whoever is trying to come here, this doesn't impugn their desires. Their desires are quite possibly for just a better life, but we do need to have some control over the border. So I don't, again, I guess to my point, David, or to address your point, I don't view this through the religious lens that the vice president seems to. Latin was the one class I think I got a D in college, so my Latin isn't very good. But I am concerned more globally that if we believe the way that it was outlined by the vice president, and this is where I differ, frankly, I think from the vice president and the president, that it somehow diminishes what has made America that shining city on the hill, that makes migrants want to come to this country because we have opened our arms, because we have led by example, because we do care about others who aren't just neighbors who live down the street from us. We saw that in the Marshall Plan after World War II, and we've seen that in any number of cases with George Bush and the amount of aid that went to Africa to combat AIDS. I mean, there are so many, and these are conservative things that I'm talking about. I mean, there's a whole host of other programs that I could cite as well, but I think that's what makes America unique. So I'm very concerned. I want a strong border. I want us to make sure that we know who's coming in to this country. Because while the vast majority of migrants might be just looking for a better life, there are some bad actors who come in. So I want that, but I don't necessarily want to diminish the fact that what's made America stand out on the world stage is because we're better than just caring about the folks that live on our street.
Lily, how does Ordo Amoris land with you?
I mean, I agree. I also was a poor Latin student in every aspect when I took it in school.
I didn't even take Latin. So You are crazy to even try. Like, what are you doing?
Totally insane. But let's put it this way. Let's just, for a second, let's take him at his word and let's say that that is how he views the world and that's how he views prioritization of resources, of funds, of the role of government. Fine. If you think that you need to take care of American citizens first, then why are you threatening the 70 million people who are on Medicaid that pays for 40% of births in this country and covers 40% of kids? Why are you canceling grants that pay for school meals for kids who are too poor to be able to pay for their own? Why are you, you know, canceling nutrition programs for pregnant women and their infants? I just don't think that his logic holds up when you look at the domestic priorities of this administration. And so, again, I completely agree with Mike. I philosophically disagree. I think that America has a role to play in the world, especially in a world that is shrinking by the day with more interconnectivity than we've ever seen. But also, I think if you say that you believe that you want to take care of American citizens, I do not think that this administration's proposals, whether the cutting of grants or their budget proposals, reflect a desire to do that.
I mean, Mike, I guess I'm curious how you would handle some of those questions. Like, do you, if we take Vance at his word, do you see policies, domestic policies, coming from this administration, or let's say Republicans in general, like in Congress, that are focused on this philosophy of we should make sure that we're taking care of the people closest to us, neighbors, family, but, you know, in this for purposes of this conversation, people at home and in the United States right now?
Well, if I'm to make an argument for the, you know, for the administration on this, and I'm going to push back on Lily again a little bit on this, I think a lot of the points that she's making, we'll see where we have cuts to services or whether we have cuts to services. We've got the president and others saying we're not going to cut Medicaid, and we'll see when we get the one big beautiful bill. So let me just put a little pin in that. But I do think that a lot of the programs that the administration has been doing, which is, you know, curtailing the spending on programs that, frankly, I think the American people would be surprised that we're funding. And I don't want to get into a whole laundry list of what DOGE has found or departments that have been shut down or, you know, ideology has infected our public policy in a way that maybe it hadn't over. You know, hadn't 20 years ago, and shutting those programs down so that the monies that we do have coming into the government are more are able to be used in better fashion to actually benefit people rather than just pushing an ideology. So from that standpoint, I'd argue that this administration does care about its neighbors, does care about the people in the United States, and does have an inward look to say we're here for the American people.
All right, we're going to take one more break, and Mike and Lily and I will come back and pick up this conversation in just a moment with more Left, Right, and Center. All right, we're back with Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green. Moa Lathy and Sarah Isger are off this week, but we're happy to have Mike Dupke on the right and Lily Adams on the left. I want to keep talking a little bit about immigration and the concept of Ordo Amoris, order of love that we were speaking about before the break. You know, the Pope, when he wrote that letter to Catholic bishops in the United States, did make clear, I mean, he said it is possible to have an effective immigration policy, even as you care for and show empathy to migrants. And I wonder, and Mike, this is something I know that you brought up as we were planning the show, like, is it more a question of, or in some large part, a question of language and how we talk about people around the world and what their stories are about? Because this all got me just thinking about, you know, some of the things that bother me about what I hear from the Trump administration. Sometimes it's really just about how they are describing other humans. It's not necessarily about this policy or that policy. And I feel like that might have been some of the Pope's message as well. I mean, part of Francis's legacy was just respecting the dignity of migrants and people who are moving and or trying to move to different parts of the world because of their circumstances. Is there a way to have a tougher immigration policy, but to message it in a respectful way that respects the dignity of people?
I am sure that in the same way that the language that the president uses, where it creates a trigger for individuals who don't particularly agree with his policies, that his language, and this is the point I was trying to make, that language matters so much, that his language is absolutely just grates, you know, nails on a chalkboard for them in much the same way. And you're going to be very mad at me when I say this, that when I'm listening to NPR and I hear the way things are described in a different context, where I am looking and saying, that's not, you're using language that does not correctly show what or talk about what we are conversing about here. For example,
what's an example of that? Yeah, please.
Yeah, well, for example,
you're not making me mad, by the way.
Let's stay with immigration. I think immigration is one of those areas in which when somebody is in this country, and I'm not casting any aspersions on why they're here, but when somebody did not go through the proper legal process, to call them an illegal immigrant, meaning that they broke the rules that we have for somebody to cross the border and come into this country, to me is not pejorative. To me, that is an easy descriptor. But the AP back in 2013 decided that we no longer can use the word illegal. We have to use the convoluted language of they don't have the proper identification papers to be in this country. They never actually gave, I went back and I looked at this, the AP never actually gave guidance to anyone what they should say. They gave a long list of other words that you shouldn't use, and then you can be euphemistic about somebody being in this country. I don't think saying illegal immigrant or illegal migrant or whatever is a bad way to say it, but others do. And I think it's a precursor to, when you change the language in such a way, it's a precursor to trying to change the policy. When you force all of legacy media, because AP has that power, to not use a term that is fairly common for most people talking about this issue, I think you're making a huge policy statement, and they're saying, no, this is, you know, we're just making a small change. I think language is that important around this. So that's one example, David.
No, it's really interesting because I remember being in newsrooms when that conversation was happening, and what we were told was that it was to avoid, you know, adjectives to describe a person that were basically labeling them and saying, like, you should be known as this thing, illegal. Not like, you know, a mom or a dad or a human or a contractor or a doctor or a physician. It's like, this is the label. But I did not realize that changing the language can be triggering to some people who are consuming news content that way. Lily, what are your thoughts on that?
Honestly, I mean, as a communications person, you'd think I'd have more strong feelings about this, but obviously this is something Mike's carried around for a decade, so I haven't thought about it as much. But I do think there is a credible case, just to agree with them slightly, there's a credible case to be made that we have spent a lot of time and energy tiptoeing around different ways and how to come up with the least offensive way to talk about things, that at some point, for my side of the aisle, has sort of cluttered the message and made people feel like we're not speaking directly to them. And that is a fair critique and something that we have to address. I think on the issue of immigration, the bigger problem I have with this president is not the language that he uses. It's that I actually don't think he's that interested in a solution. I think he likes this issue as a politically motivating issue for his base. And we went through this in 2024, where we had a border security bill that would have given DHS more power to restrict and secure the border. It would have given more restrictions on asylum seekers. It was endorsed by the literal border agents. And the president told Republicans in Congress not to pass it because he wanted the issue for the election. So I don't take this president at good faith that he is interested in a real solution. And the only other point I'd sort of point to is like, he's got control, unified control of government. Why isn't he passing a comprehensive immigration bill? If immigration is the number one problem, if it is so, you know, just like sticks in his craw, send up a bill and fix this comprehensively. Instead, what he's doing is a kind of like one size fits all approach. He's disregarding court orders, including the United States Supreme Court on immigration. There's just, if you really wanted to solve this, there are better ways. Other presidents have tried. He could do it. He's not going to do it because he likes the politics.
Well, let me just agree with you on one, or agree with you on one thing, Lily, on this. I don't understand why we don't have a comprehensive immigration bill. I disagree with you on the description of the bill that we had back in 2024, because frankly, the Biden administration put that bill into effect with their executive orders, and you saw the border crossings plummet because of it. So they had the ability to do it. Problem with executive orders that this president loves, Biden loved as well, as did other presidents, is they only last as long as your presidency. And because we have unified government right now, I couldn't agree with you more that we should have comprehensive immigration reform, because that will last longer than this administration and past 2028. The only way to make permanent change, in the best sense of the way permanent, what permanent means in Washington, D.C., is to have Congress pass a bill. This executive order after executive order just doesn't cut it on these big issues, and shouldn't cut it.
All right. I want to get to one listener question before we go. And it actually, it goes back to a question that came up when the Trump administration was putting demands on Harvard and other universities to improve what the administration views as a problem, a lacking in viewpoint diversity on college campuses. So this question comes from Carl in Minnesota.
I am a former Republican and current moderate, and I want to talk about viewpoint diversity in college campuses. First of all, just full stop, I don't support really anything the Trump administration does, particularly regarding education. But there are real issues of viewpoint diversity on college campuses that do need to be addressed locally and at the state level. For example, I teach in teacher education, and we are required to do what the state says in terms of the standards for future teachers. And the standards that Minnesota sets, for example, are very much on the left. For example, in education, it's not enough for us to teach teachers how to teach their content or how to teach reading or about child development even. Rather, they need to learn how to disrupt systems of oppression. And that has really strong, I think, political slants and biases. But this isn't a federal issue. This is a state issue. And I do think there needs to be conversations about how colleges can be more reflective of communities, not just in terms of race and ethnicity, but in terms of viewpoints, in order to seem more relevant for all community members, not just for people doing research. Thanks.
Mike, does Carl have a point?
I think Carl is a true Republican. He believes in states' rights. He believes, you know, that the laboratories of democracy are where we should have this debate, and individuals can choose if they want to live in that society or move and live in another state in which the rules of the road are different. I do think he's got a point. The problem is we have federalized a lot of things in this country, and that's not just this administration. This is going back, you know, decades, where we have tried to not have differences have not been celebrated. And when you've got previous administrations that are not allowing states to make their own choices and make their own rules, and they're federalizing all of the above, I think the natural outcropping of that is to find an administration, a conservative administration, or the Trump administration trying to do the exact same thing. So to me, this is, when I listen to Carl's question, I'm hearing states' rights versus, you know, I'm hearing a federal debate here. Rather than the specifics. And I think this is a problem that we've been experiencing for decades now.
You know, Lily, I think about it. I mean, I thought about my own college experience when the Trump administration brought up viewpoint diversity. And I did feel like, you know, in general, my classmates who had more conservative political views sometimes didn't feel as comfortable in debates, you know, in classes and so forth. But the way the Trump administration brought it up, I mean, it felt heavy-handed. It felt ridiculous. I mean, it just felt like it was taking independence away from, I mean, I could go on and on, but I wonder, is what is what Carl's bringing up here is this one way to sort of explore it, like to have conversations in states around the country about whether public universities and other schools, you know, reflect the diversity of their communities in all ways.
Yeah, look, I think just to maybe talk about higher education for a minute, because I think that was a part of his question, you know, higher education have a lot of tough questions to answer right now as they sort of look to the future and as they're under attack. I generally agree with the questioner and the listener that, you know, a broad, not just a broad sort of array of viewpoints, but also a broad array of experiences leads to a better, more well-rounded education. You're not going to get a good education if you're surrounded by people who just think just like you. I think some schools have done a good job trying to solve this in the student body, but I don't think, where I think is the toughest nut to crack, that I don't think that they've done a good job at addressing this at the faculty level. You still see that faculty, I think, is, you know, just, you know, they're mostly progressive, mostly liberal. And I think that they're also mostly academic. You know, I think that actually schools would do a lot better to have a faculty with more practitioners in this environment, with more people who, you know, didn't come up through the tenure track, who have more lived life experience. So I think it's not just that they need more ideological diversity. I think they also need more just life diversity in general.
All right. Well, we appreciate the question, and send us your questions. If we'd love to hear from you, if you've got a question that you'd like us to take up on the show, if you could, you know, do a voice memo, maybe 30 seconds or so, send it by email to lrc@kcrw.org. That address again, lrc@kcrw.org. And we're going to leave it there. And we're going to move on to our left, right, and center rants and raves. Lily, since this is your first time on the show with us, I will let you start. The floor is yours.
Okay, I have a rave because I tried to keep it positive, having discussed so many crazy things going on. But I am raving about The Pitt, which is a TV show that's on HBO, which has popularity that is about an emergency room in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I think the best thing about this show is that it sort of explores all these really complicated, difficult issues that we're talking about on this show, you know, issues of identity, of political sort of viewpoints, of violence, of guns, of obviously vaccines, but does it in a way that isn't heavy-handed, it isn't judgmental. It sort of is reflective of how real communities deal with these things. And I just think they also put a spotlight on, you know, healthcare workers who are just true American heroes in my book. So highly recommend it. Have really enjoyed it.
I could not agree more. I'm going to admit that I was in my hotel room in Philadelphia at midnight in bed watching two more episodes on my phone. I mean, it's addictive. Mike Dupke.
When you're bringing up one of these shows, I've got a rant. I've been watching 1923, and this is a spoiler alert. There is a scene near the penultimate episode in which the wife, pregnant wife of the son, prodigal son that is coming home, gets in a car in Chicago in 1923 and tries to drive to Montana in the winter. The Brits that drive her, even though the woman in Wyoming says, "Don't go any farther, you will die," continue to drive. She falls asleep in the back seat, somehow survives, and the two other people are frozen solid in this car. Now, I haven't gotten to the final episode. I don't know how she actually gets to Montana. I know that she does because, you know, everyone's talking about it online. But it was so unbelievable. It took a show that I really, really enjoyed and drove it so deep in the ground with this unbelievable scene of people freezing in this car. How stupid were they? It upset me so much. I had to turn off the television and walk away. And that's my rant. And I wasn't going to talk about it. Maybe I got a little too passionate about it, but God, that was stupid.
Well, don't mess with Mike's shows. That's the bottom line.
I think Mike needs to start watching The Pitt.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to be really brief. I'm going to rave about 100 days because everyone's going to complain that it's this fake milestone used every time there's a new presidency. Trump's is coming up. He's going to Michigan. I want to hate it. I usually hate milestones that, like, what happens if he declares war on day 102? We're not even going to think about the first 100 days. But I actually think in every presidency, it's like a good moment where people actually reflect and say what has been done, what has been accomplished, or what has not been accomplished, and who has been served or who has been not served. So I used to hate it, but now I'm kind of loving the 100 days marker, and we're about to hit one. Okay, Mike Lilly, thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate it. And also want to thank the team putting the show together every week. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Mark K. Green. Our executive producer is Arnie Seipel. The show is recorded by Sue Margulies. It is mixed by Nick Lamponi. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media. We are distributed by PRX, and we also appreciate the great team here at WHYY in Philadelphia for hosting me to do the show this week. I'm David Green. Thanks for being here. Come back next week. We'll have more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.